Well, hey, everybody, we'll go ahead and get started. We may have a few trickle in here later. Did everybody get a note sheet?
Yep.
Yes? Awesome. So today, we're talking about four bad communication tactics of couples. And pardon me if it sounds like I'm sick. It's because I am. I just have a sore throat, but you can thank my toddler for that. Do what? I'm going to try. Yeah. So on the schedule, if you had the schedule, if you looked at the schedule, you saw that today was originally called the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and their sidekicks. I thought that was a little intense because that's what Gottman calls them. And as I was thinking about this and studying and putting all this together, like the apocalypse is the revelation of the end of the world. And like what he's talking about is these four things, these four horsemen often lead to the end of a marriage. And so thinking about that from a secular worldview, that makes sense. But thinking about it from a biblical worldview, it doesn't make sense. Because that's not biblical grounds for divorce. So that's why we changed it to four bad communication tactics of couples. And also it just sounds nicer for the conversation that we're about to have. This one's going to hurt. It hurt me when I read it. It hurt me when I was studying. It hurt me when I was prepping because I've done all these. And if you're real honest, you have too at some point in your marriage. And so what we're going to do is we're going to talk about signs and we're going to talk about actions. Okay. Signs are just things that are going to, or that things that will show that the conversation is not going to go well. And then actions are things that we do in that conversation to our spouse. Okay. And then we'll come back at the end and talk about, all right, how do we look at this from a biblical worldview and how do we approach each other in conversations when there is conflict and we're just not communicating. So the goal of today is to get you to see, to step back and get a 30,000 foot view of yourself and of your marriage and of your own communication habits, so that when you feel pulled to do one of these things, you'll catch it and you'll stop. Okay. So let's go ahead and jump in. The first sign of trouble is a harsh startup. The first sign of trouble in a conversation is a harsh startup. Gottman says, statistics tell us that 96% of the time you can predict the outcome of a conversation based on the first 3 minutes of a 15-minute interaction. A harsh startup simply dooms you to failure. So if you begin a discussion that way, you might as well pull the plug, take a breather, and start over. And like we talked about last week, a soft answer from Proverbs 15:1, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. So if you're in a conversation and your tone is already elevated, your tone is already agitated, and you're frustrated, and that comes across in your body language and in your tone, that conversation will not go well. And how often do we continue on down that road and continue on in that vein of just anger and I'm going to prove that I'm right and I'm going to beat you into submission with my words and my argument style and all this. So if you find in yourself a harsh startup, that's a sign. Like, nobody wants to have a difficult, hard conversation with no positive end result. Nobody wants that, right? I can't think of one spouse that says, you know what, I really want to get into an argument with my wife and just make her feel like trash. That's what I want out of this. Or I've never met a wife who's like, you know what, I just want to make my husband feel really, really small right now. That's never happened. Like, we all want to walk away from a conversation with a positive result, with the goal being change or at least harmony. And a harsh startup dooms that right off. Okay, so that's the first sign of trouble. The first action that comes across as criticism. Okay, now there's a difference between a complaint and a criticism. Okay, now we attach negative connotations to both of those, but actually complaints can lead to positive results. Okay, and here's why. A complaint focuses on a specific behavior or event. Okay, it focuses on a specific behavior or event. And there's three parts of a complaint. Here's how I feel about this situation, and here's what I want slash need slash prefer. Okay. And so statements that contain complaints are soft startups. So for example, hey, you said that you would gas up my car for me. I don't have enough gas. I'm gonna have to do that and I'm gonna be late where I'm going. Next time I would prefer that you would fill up the gas, like fill up my car whenever you say you would. I'd really appreciate that. Rather than, how can you be so inconsiderate that your car always has gas, my car doesn't? Why can't you know what I need? Okay? That's a criticism, okay? So a solution in this is using the sentence stems I notice and I prefer. Okay? I notice and I prefer. So like in this example, like, hey, I notice that you've been really distracted lately. You got a lot going on with your work. I know that. But I also noticed that you said that you were going to fill up my car with gas and you didn't. I prefer that you would do that. I can remind you if I need to. And what that does very often in our complaints, or in our, even in our criticisms, we don't take any responsibility for a possible solution. So what we do in that, without using I notice and I prefer, what we do is we put the entire burden of responsibility on our spouse instead of coming alongside, being a partner in equal worth and dignity and saying, hey, this is a problem. You're not the problem, but this is a problem. I'm going to help find the solution rather than saying, you screwed up, you figure it out. I'm just going to sit over here and be mad. Okay? And that's where we get into criticism. So a complaint focuses on a specific behavior or event. A criticism is global in scope and expresses negative feelings or opinions about the other's character or personality. Instead of, hey, you said you filled up my car with gas and you didn't, a criticism is, you're an inconsiderate jerk. How could you? That's a criticism, right? So statements that contain criticisms are harsh startups. Very common forms of criticisms contain statements that say you always or you never. You always or you never. Those are criticisms. And whenever I catch myself on the other side of an argument where I've ever said you always or you never, the only thing that we're always doing is breathing. Like no one always does something all the time other than breathe. Right? Like we're constantly in a state of flux. Our personalities change, our actions change, our behaviors change, our moods change. So telling your spouse, you always do this or you never do this, aside from being harsh, that's also not accurate. Okay? It's not accurate. And so the biggest complaint of them all is, what's wrong with you? That's when you know you've crossed from complaint into criticism. When you attack your spouse's character, what's wrong with you? You're the problem. I'm not the problem. You're the problem. Okay? So a complaint example is, there's no gas in the car. I'm upset with you. You didn't fill up like you said. Could you please deal with it tomorrow? Criticism, why can't you ever remember anything? Told you 1,000 times to fill up the tank and you didn't. You're always so careless. That's also another one. You always, you never, or I've told you 1,000 times. I can't think of anything I've said 1,000 times. So again, just not accurate. When you cross into hyperbole, that's when you know you're criticizing and you need to stop. Okay? And so criticism paves the way for the next horseman or the next action. So we have criticism leads to contempt. Okay? Criticism leads to contempt. And this contempt arises from a sense of superiority to your spouse. You think that you're better, smarter, stronger, more competent than your spouse. You might not say it, but if you're showing contempt to your spouse, you feel it. And this is a form of disrespect, and it negates the fact that your spouse is a part of you. You are part of them. They're equal in worth and dignity. No one is superior to the other. No one is superior to the other in marriage. Okay? So ways that contempt comes out: sarcasm, cynicism, eye-rolling, name-calling, mockery, and hostile humor are all forms of contempt. So when you think about your interactions with your spouse, see if any of those have ever come out. And again, like this might hurt, and we're going to get to some good stuff at the end, but reading through this list, like you might feel convicted, you might feel like, oh man, that's me, I've done that. That's okay. It's okay to feel that. And it's good to feel that and let that move you towards repentance and change. Okay? So Gottman says, in whatever form, sarcasm, cynicism, eye-rolling, whatever, contempt is poisonous to a relationship because it conveys disgust. It is virtually impossible to resolve a problem when your partner is getting the message that you're disgusted with him or her. Inevitably, contempt leads to more conflict rather than reconciliation. So the next time that you are exercising a behavior that conveys contempt, like, you're basically looking at your spouse in the eye and saying, you disgust me. And I don't think, again, I don't think we would ever say that to our spouse, but we act that way towards them in these veiled ways, because sarcasm or hostile humor is a whole lot easier to do than just to flat out say, you disgust me. Okay? So couples who, this was interesting, I just put this in here. Couples who are contemptuous of each other are more likely to suffer from infectious illnesses, cold, flu, so on, than other people. So very much so, like, it not only poisons your relationship, but like also poisons your body, just because there's biological data that shows that married couples who are in healthy communication and in healthy relationships, their physical health is better. But couples who are constantly warring and constant, the stress that it puts on their body weakens their immune system. Contempt is fueled by long simmering negative thoughts about your spouse. So what's at the root of it? Long simmering, not communicated negative thoughts about your spouse, which we all have. And there's healthy ways to communicate those, like going back to complaints, right? Contempt is fueled by long simmering negative thoughts about your spouse. You just get stuck in this web of, they never do this, they always do this. It's like we talked about last week. You view your spouse through negative sentiment override, where just you view them as fundamentally selfish. And that's just not true. Okay? So the third action, so we have contempt. Then we get to the third action is defensiveness. Okay? Defensiveness is a way of blaming your partner in all of its forms. It just escalates the conflict and doesn't de-escalate it. So if your partner gives you, if they throw a soft startup in a complaint and you meet that with defensiveness, that's not going to go well. Like, our number one tactic is self-justification. We don't like to be told we're wrong. We don't like to be told that we messed up. We don't like to be told that something's wrong with us. And so we self-justify, and that's defensiveness. Rather than hearing something from your spouse and receiving it humbly, we puff our chests up and say, how, I know exactly what's wrong with you, and you're thinking that something's wrong with me. Let me tell you what's wrong with you. And that does nothing but continue to raise the temperature in the conversation and continue to raise the temperature in the marriage. And that doesn't do anybody any good, and that conversation is doomed. If you are defending yourself, now there is a way to do that. Like, if there is justification for you to defend yourself, there is a way to do that in a way that does not hurt your spouse, but more often than not, that comes in a conversation that begins with a soft startup, where you can just simply say, like in the gas in the car conversation, soft startup. Hey, you said you put gas in the car. You didn't. I'd really appreciate it if you did it tomorrow. Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I just got so swamped with things at work, or I meant to put gas in the car and then something else came up and I didn't tell you that something else came up. I'm sorry, I'll go put gas in the car tomorrow. That's a way to be defensive and not wound your spouse. Okay?
Question.
Yeah.
From last week, what was the definition of the term that lowers temperature in a room? Like, you find maybe in this dynamic situation you're talking about, shoot, my partner getting defensive, how do I lower the temperature?
Yeah, it's a repair attempt. Yeah, that's a repair attempt. And like I said last week, you could even say, I am using a repair attempt. We need to stop for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, use a funny joke or something. And that's where you have to know your spouse for a repair attempt to work. But yeah, that's what that is.
Okay.
Yeah. So defensiveness is the third one. And then the last one is stonewalling. Gottman says, in marriages where discussions begin with a harsh startup, where criticism and contempt lead to defensiveness and vice versa, eventually one partner tunes out. This trumpets the arrival of the fourth horseman, where you just completely turn off. By turning away from your spouse in conflict, you're turning away from your marriage. And stonewalling is more common in husbands than it is in wives. Our number one tactic is to just withdraw and shut off rather than step in and engage. And we'll talk here in just a second about why we do that. But that second point, by turning away from your spouse in conflict, you're turning away from your marriage. I cannot remember who it was. I think it was Dan Doriani or somebody who said that he has interviewed women who said that they would rather their husband be physically abusive to them than stonewall them. Because at least that shows some kind of emotion towards them. What women can't stand is just the emotional distance and the silence. And of course, they obviously wouldn't want that, but if they had to pick one of the two, they would rather pick the physical abuse, because then that means that there's some passion and that there's some emotion behind it, rather than just, you know what, forget it, I'm out. Because we do that. That's what we're communicating. Like, I'm not divorcing you, but I'm definitely not engaging with you right now. I'm definitely not trying to understand you right now. I'm not loving you. I'm out. I'm going to go to the other side of the house. That's what stonewalling communicates to our spouse. And so this leads to the second sign of trouble, flooding. And this is why we, mostly husbands, but wives do it too, engage in stonewalling. And so Gottman has this term called flooding. Usually people stonewall as a protection against feeling psychologically and physically overwhelmed, a sensation called flooding. It occurs when your spouse's negativity is so intense and sudden that it leaves you shell-shocked. You feel so defenseless against the sniper attack that you learn to do anything to avoid a replay. The more often you feel flooded by your spouse's criticism and contempt, the more hypervigilant you are for cues that your spouse is about to blow again. And so this is why we stonewall. I'm just not going to say anything to upset. And this is where we get into, I'd rather have quiet than peace. Those are two different things. So when we get to flooding, when we feel flooded and we stonewall, we're choosing quiet over peace, because peace is accomplished by stepping in, taking the hits, taking the negativity, taking the contempt, and trying to find a solution. Quiet is just backing out. And so when we feel flooded, that's what we're tempted, like your body is telling, it's kicking in the fight or flight response. And that's where we get to the third sign, body language. We can see just how physically distressing flooding is. One of the most apparent of these physical reactions is that the heart speeds up, pounding away at more than 100 beats a minute, even as high as 165 beats a minute. In contrast, a typical heart rate for a man who's about 30 is 76. For a woman the same age, is about 82. So body language signals that at least one partner feels severe emotional distress when dealing with the other. And so your body is kicking, it's trying to protect you from feeling this emotional backlash and just this emotional weight. And so you back out. You can't leave, so you just emotionally withdraw. It's the physical sensation of feeling flooded, the increased heart rate, sweating, and so on, make it virtually impossible to have a productive problem-solving discussion. And so this is where it should be okay when you're in a heated argument with your spouse, for you to have the room to say, I'm feeling flooded right now, and this is not going to lead to anything productive. I need to back out and calm down. There needs to be room for that in heated conversations. Because we talked about, I think, week one or week two, you're going to argue and you're going to fight, and there might be some screaming matches. That's going to happen. Daniel, what did I tell you when y'all were engaged? I said, you're going to fight with somebody the rest of your life. Do you want it to be Hannah? You're going to fight with somebody for the rest of your life. Fighting and conflict is inevitable because your sin and my sin. You're going to fight. how you engage in that, there needs to be rules and there needs to be ground rules for how to do that. And there needs to be room in those arguments for one spouse to say to the other, I'm feeling flooded right now and that's not going to help the situation. I need to back out. And then to back out and in communicating that, you're not saying, I'm stonewalling you, I'm backing, like I don't want anything to do with you. Because you're communicating, I want this to be productive. I want this to be a healthy, good conversation that leads to harmony and peace. But I just can't clear my head and I can't calm my body down to think clearly about this. I need a minute. Okay? Godwin says, all those distressful reactions like a pounding heart and sweating occur because of a fundamental, on a fundamental level, your body perceives your current situation is dangerous. It's dangerous.
John, I have a question.
Shoot.
So how would a timeout look different from just regular stonewalling?
So in regular stonewalling, there's no communication about why the timeout's happening. Stonewalling is just silence because you don't want to deal. But a timeout is communicating, I want to talk about this, but my body, like I know what's going on in my body right now, and it's not going to lead to anything productive happening in this conversation. I want this to be a productive conversation. I want you to know that, but right now, I just need a minute.
Okay.
Stonewalling is just total withdrawal.
Okay.
Yeah. Good question. Good question.
Sometimes stonewalling too can just be a tactic.
Mm-hmm.
That it may not be as active as it's presented here. It may just be what happens naturally.
Yeah.
Because you just, if you do feel overwhelmed or flooded and you want to take a step back, reality is what happens in those few minutes that you're taking a step back, you get involved with something else.
Yeah.
She gets involved with something else and you have a hard time coming back to the table. So as you go through these things,
yeah,
if you do a lot of that, then it just happens because we tend to be passive.
Yeah.
It's so much harder to engage the problem.
Yeah.
Because when you take a break, you get, I mean, time just happens.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's an incredible amount of initiative.
It does.
To re-enter that fray again.
It does. Yeah. That's where the bedrock, the engine, like building on the friendship and understanding that there's safety in the marriage, to where you feel comfortable bringing something back up, because there is that temptation towards passivity. You're like, you know what? She isn't bringing it up. I'm not going to bring it up either. So let's just deal. And that's choosing quiet over peace. And so, because what happens is if you leave conflict unresolved, that sinks down into those negative feelings. Yeah.
Josh, I think that's a great point.
Mm-hmm.
Busyness of everything makes that super easy to do. Just
yep.
Yeah. One thing we started doing 2 or 3 months ago, we'll see. We'll give you a sit right along.
Yeah.
Just really tried every morning to walk about a mile and a half a night together. So it's 30 minutes twice a day, beginning and end. And we'll see. I mean, the idea is, well, even though logistics get discussed in there, it's long enough each time that you know you can get past that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in intense periods of other stresses, which we have going on, just changes in life and all that stuff. Hopefully, all those things that would otherwise just passively be left on the side until they build up to some big deal, pressure will get left off in the middle. We'll see.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It kind of depends on not being a little bit hurt for this stuff along the way, too.
Yeah.
It's, you know, at least to process and see if you have some problems.
That's good. That's good.
That for you, kids.
That's
yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. No. Yeah, yeah, we did, and we mapped out our whole lives on the box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no accident, Steve. Like, this is starting when we're empty nesters.
Serious kids.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the deal.
Yeah.
Kids are great.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, kids are blessing.
I love them so much.
Yeah.
That
and doing stuff like that and the way that you have those conversations and using those sentence stems like I notice and I prefer. There's another one a guy named Pete Scazzaro uses that he says literally has cut his sinning down in half. He calls them puzzles, and he literally just says, I'm puzzled why you said this or why you did this. And it just it's not a criticism, like, why'd you do that? But just, hey, I'm curious why you said that this way. Or I'm curious why you did that. Because what we're often tempted to do is to go ahead and pronounce judgment on our head. Well, this is why they said this, because they're naturally selfish or whatever, whatever. And that's where you get negative sentiment override. But by opening it up and saying, hey, I'm puzzled, or I wonder why you said this, or what's going on, or this, that just opens the door to a conversation. You're not pronouncing judgment on your spouse already. So having walks like that, or because you got kids, you can't, you know, just lock the house and leave them in there. I mean, you could. You could, but then the police get involved and it's a whole big thing. But like just sitting on the couch together and just having that conversation, like, hey, you said this to me earlier today and it sounded like you were a little mad. I wonder why you said that this way. And just having some wonder and some puzzles, that's another thing that helps lower the temperature. Like genuinely, because sometimes we can ask a question and we're not really asking a question, right? And that comes across in our body language and our tone. But just asking a genuine question is a great soft startup to a what could be a difficult conversation. Okay?
You can visualize it, like the softer words, like I'm
talking
about. You can visualize cracking the door open.
Yeah.
Instead of you always, it is like kicking the door down.
Oh, yeah.
So it's pretty easy to feel it coming on. It's like, hang on. Let's do a gentler word. Like,
and that's
I've noticed.
Yeah. And that's a good way. That's a good way to think about it. You're cracking the door instead of kicking it down, because in movies, does anybody kick a door down to have a party? No. Somebody's in trouble.
John Belushi.
Yeah. John Belushi. Yeah. All right. So when we get to flooding, the ability to process information is reduced, making it nearly impossible to pay attention to what your spouse is saying. Creative problem solving is gone, leaving you with your instinctual fight or flight response, neither of which is conducive to solving marital conflict. That's where we get more defensiveness. You're in a fight, so you're going to defend. Biologically, men are more easily overwhelmed by marital conflict than their wives. So, guys, understand that about yourself. Do whatever you need to calm yourself down. Wives, understand this about your husbands. Like, biologically, men are more easily overwhelmed by marital conflict than their wives. So the way you approach him in the soft startup or the harsh startup is going to dictate how that conversation is going to go. And again, everybody wants a productive conversation. Nobody wants to just annihilate their spouse. Gottman says, frequently feeling flooded leads almost inevitably to emotional distancing, stonewalling, which in turn leads to feeling lonely. A spouse that stonewall, emotional distance, they may go through the motions of togetherness, attending children's plays, hosting dinner parties, taking family vacations, but emotionally they no longer feel connected to each other. They have given up because the damage of the flooding and the continual push into that has so emotionally damaged both of them that they know they can't leave, but they're definitely not together. Okay? And the fourth sign of trouble is failed repair attempts. Okay? Failed repair attempts. Gottman says, repair attempts save marriages, not just because they decrease emotional tension between spouses, but because by lowering the stress level, they also prevent your heart from racing and making you feel flooded. When the four horsemen rule a couple's communication, repair attempts often don't even get noticed, especially when you're feeling flooded. You're not able to hear the verbal white flag. So you may be in a conversation and your spouse is feeling flooded, and they're like, you know what, you're right, I'm sorry, like, I'm on your side, I'm on your team, and you can't even hear, you're just continuing to steamroll and steamroll and steamroll. So you might not even hear the repair attempt, which is not good, because what that does, a failed repair attempt, like if I'm in conflict with Aaron and I lob a repair attempt trying to fix the situation or at least bring the temperature down, and if she's so wrapped up and so hurt emotionally that she can't even hear it, what that says to me is, oh man, she really doesn't care about what I have to say or what I'm feeling. Like, she just wants to be right, and that creates more emotional distance. And so this, again, takes communication, it takes practice, but understanding when your spouse is giving a repair attempt and catching it rather than letting it drop, that does damage as well. Like, there's no neutral when a repair attempt is offered. Like, it either works or it doesn't, and when it doesn't, it hurts the person that's trying to repair. Okay? And this is where we get James 19 through 20. Know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. So when we're in a conversation with our spouse and we're angry and we're frustrated and they have sinned against us and they are 99% in the wrong, and we want to tell them that they're 99% in the wrong, or maybe they're 100% in the wrong, even in those moments, we need to remember James 1:20, where God's word tells us the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. My anger is not going to make Aaron more righteous. My anger is not going to make my wife more holy. My anger is not going to make my children more holy. That has never happened. In the history of mankind, no one has ever been made more righteous because of the anger of their spouse. And so we need to remember that, so that when we're in those conversations, we can hear those repair attempts and we can listen to our spouse and we can try to understand. Again, even if they're 99% in the wrong, you only help the situation by trying to understand and moving towards and listening. A fifth sign of trouble is bad memories. Gottman says, I've found over and over that couples who are deeply entrenched in a negative view of their spouse and their marriage often rewrite their past. Another sad sign is when either or both partners find the past difficult to remember. It has become so unimportant or painful that they've let it fade away. When the four horsemen move in for good, the negativity gets so thick that everything a spouse does or ever did is recast in a negative light. The first Wednesday night class that we had of this, one of the things I wanted us to do was to share the story, and it's up here on the board too, to share the story of how we met, got engaged, and the wedding day. Just to kind of just share with the group to help us get to know one another, but also to hear ourselves tell the story. Because the way we live in the stories that we tell ourselves. We live in the stories that we tell ourselves. And so if you're here and you've got these bad memories and where everything in your past is either hard to remember or negative, that's a problem. And something's up. And there needs to be some digging up of some bad feelings and some communication. Because when the four horsemen move in for good, negativity gets so thick that everything the spouse does or ever did, even if they had the most amazing proposal, even if they planned the entire wedding, everything that they did gets cast in a negative light because of the four horsemen. Okay? So, last page. Gottman says, bolstering your friendship is so critical in large part because it fuels the romance, the passion, and great sex that we all hope marriage will provide. Positive sentiment override is like an insurance policy. It dramatically increases the odds that repair attempts will regularly work and diffuse the tension. And again, I think I said this last week, sociologists have come up with the formula, like it takes 20 positive interactions to override one negative interaction with your spouse. 20 positive actions to override one negative interaction. So, what do we need to remember? Things to remember when we're in conversation. In conversation with our spouse, and in conversation with ourselves, Hebrews 9:14. How much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? The blood of Christ not only cleanses your soul, but it can also cleanse your conscience. Like the negative sentiment override that you have about yourself. Like the blood of Christ can cover that. All the sin, all of the dirt, all of the mess that you have brought into your marriage, the blood of Christ covers that. And so that should reframe how you view yourself, and that should reframe how you enter into a conversation that's going to be difficult. And so first, and this was one of the principles that we talked about the very first day in this class, no one has ever been changed for the better by guilt and shame. Like, you're going to go into a week this week where you're probably going to get into a difficult conversation with your spouse, and you'll probably walk in this room next week tempted to put on a mask and say, oh, everything's great, everything's awesome, and it's not. And inside what you're doing is you're just sitting in guilt and shame. You're not the only ones who have had marital conflict this week, and you won't be the only ones that have marital conflict this coming week. So when we come in here, we leave guilt at the door because the blood of Christ covers that. I heard one RUF pastor say, Jesus has been beat up enough for you. Stop beating yourself up. And stop beating your spouse up. Jesus got beat for them too. So we need to remember that. That the blood of Christ not only cleanses your soul, but cleanses your conscience. Those negative thoughts that we say about ourselves and those negative thoughts that we think about our spouse, because that's where we need to remember the gospel. They're a sinner just like I am. They need Jesus just like I do. I'm not morally, religiously, spiritually superior to them. Outside of Christ, I deserve hell. And they do too. And I need to remember that. Next, James 3, 8 through 10. But no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers, these things ought not be so. God has given you, husbands and wives, supernatural power in your words to either build up or completely and utterly destroy your spouse. You have supernatural power in the words you say to your husband or your wife. And I don't think that that gets communicated often enough in like premarital counseling. But I also think it's just something we forget. We just see them as a co-parent or just somebody else in the house or an obstacle to our joy or our rest or our quiet or whatever. But they are a spouse made in the image and likeness of God that has been brought to you by God for your good and for your sanctification, and they deserve to be treated as such. And God has given you, husband and wife, unbelievable supernatural power to speak life to them and to correct them lovingly. To, as Paul says in Ephesians 4, speak the truth in love. If all you give is no truth, it is all truth and no love, then you're a bully and a steamroller. Just beating your spouse over the head all day with truth, 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 truth. If you're all love and no truth, then you're a yes man or a yes woman, and that does your spouse no good either. You have to speak the truth in love. Have both of them together to build up each other in love. All right. Does anybody have any questions or comments or anything else they want to say? Hey. Yes.
When I think about that, I think, what's at the root of the criticism? Mm. Or the feeling of criticism and the feeling of overwhelm? And I think just the way we're supposed to be two becoming one flesh, and men tend to, you know, they have the leadership role. Mm. They have, I have to fix. And the women have the submissive role. And I kind of feel like, okay, everything in the world is overwhelming me, and I'm going to my husband and saying, I'm overwhelmed, and he says, I have to fix, his first reaction is, I have to fix this.
Yeah.
And I think God wants the two to become one flesh in that, and, you know, the reaction to be, how do we do this together? And it seems like then, if you kind of think about that that way, is your husband, that's his nature.
Yeah.
Is to want to take on the problem and fix it. If you come to him with problems, if you're not working this out, their initial reaction is going to be, I don't want to hear from her because all she does is come to me with problems.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Since I got it all fixed, this is all hypothetical.
Right, yeah, of course, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I think that's just the root of it is, you know, maybe coming to a marriage as two individual people and learning how, you know, God made the woman helper.
Yeah.
And so for the man to see, okay, when my wife is saying, here's a problem, it's how do we do this together?
Yeah. Man, think about how life-giving that is for a wife to go to her husband and say, there's a problem. If it's relational or if it's logistical or whatever, here's the problem. You're not the problem. And I'm not expecting you to handle this whole big weight. I'm coming alongside you and we're going to solve this together. But I want to bring up the problem to your attention. Yeah, that's beautiful. It's beautiful. Anything else?
Like to offer any help to anybody that it takes 3 minutes for a parts are. It's mine about 10 seconds.
Yes. Yeah.
So I can show you how to do it really quick. It takes you longer than 3 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a lot in here, though. So.
Yeah. That's good. And again, please don't walk out of here and feel beat up. Walk out of here feeling equipped. That's the goal. The goal is not to bring all this negativity up, like, oh yeah, like I criticized my wife this week, or man, I've got some contempt towards my spouse. That's not the goal. The goal is for, as you move into this week, to be aware that that's there and to catch it and to give you the tools to start working and exercising some of these ways so that you can have healthier communication for the good of the marriage, but ultimately for the glory of God. Like that's something else that Gottman, even in a secular book, points out, like when there's marital conflict, it doesn't just affect the husband and the wife. Like there's studies that show the marital conflict affects kids, and like stress levels in kids are higher when mom and dad can't get along. And so it's for you guys, it's for your kids, but again, ultimately it's for the glory of God.
Okay. I heard something that kind of, to me, basically what you just said in a sentence, but when we talk about problems in our marriage, it is not he is the problem, she is the problem. It is something that we together are seeking to overcome.
Yeah.
Even if their behavior is selfish,
yeah,
and you want, you know, to point at them, the problem is not them. The problem is there's something pushing us apart that we need to remove and seek to be together again.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, let me pray, and then we can keep talking if we want to. All right. Father, thank you for this morning, and thank you for bringing these things to our attention. Father, for convicting us of sin when we sin against our spouse. Father, give us eyes to see these things. When we're in conflict, give us eyes to see where we're criticizing, where we're contemptuous, where we're being defensive, where we want to stonewall. Give us safety and room to say, I need a minute. I'm not backing away and stonewalling you, but I need to calm down so this conversation can be productive for our flourishing and for the glory of God. Father, help repair attempts to be successful. Help each other, help us to see when repair attempts are being given so that the marriage can heal, the marriage can move forward. Help us to choose peace over quiet. Father, we ask all these things in Christ's name. Amen.